Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
So, Max, in your article, you talk about bridge work. Can you give us a definition of how you define bridge work and what that means in the article?
So in the article, we describe these four realms of feminist engagements with violence against women and gender-based violence. And we try to explain that institutionalization and the decline of movement feminism has sort of pulled these pieces apart into increasingly distinct and siloed realms of responses for survivors, responses to perpetrators, safety for potential targets of sexual assault and violence, and prevention with potential perpetrators. On paper, I think that prevention is often disconnected from these other realms and from feminism and social justice more broadly. But I think what we found is that on the ground, people actually are often trying to reconnect these realms. So they're trying to bring together survivors' voices into prevention, to bring self-defense into prevention, and to think about perpetrators in prevention. And we were interested in the ways that people do this in the day-to-day work. And that's what we mean when we talk about bridge work. It's sort of a broad term, but it's the name we give to all the ways that people who work in anti-violence try to bridge these divides and reconnect these siloed realms of anti-violence and to a wider social justice politics. So the example that stands out most to me would be Take Back the Night, which I think does an amazing job of bringing together survivors' voices and the public reclamation of public spaces. And I think that there's a real power to bringing those together, and I think that's a really amazing example of bridge work.
Mm-hmm. You said something about feminism. What is the role of feminism in sexual violence prevention?
I think that's one of the things that we're trying to talk about in this article is violence prevention, I think, pretty clearly has roots in feminism and social justice, but that's often not talked about in grants and program language and things like that. But we found that on the ground, not everyone, but a lot of people who do prevention do connect to this feminist or social justice view, and it's an important part of their motivations for their work and the way they see their work mattering. You know, very few people that I found are thrilled about showing changes on evaluations. You know, they find that meaningful, but what really makes them excited is showing beginnings of a sort of social justice imagination in students they work with, or sort of movement inclinations or things like that. And yeah. I think that for a lot of people, that's what, you know, gets them out of bed in the morning, is the feeling that they're part of something larger that's trying to make meaningful social, cultural, structural changes. So I think it's there, but I think it's sort of just below the surface for a lot of people.
Do you have thoughts about how bridge work can improve the efficacy of prevention efforts?
Yeah, you know, first off, I think that to some extent, bridge work is already improving the efficacy of prevention efforts. I think a lot of people who do prevention do bridge work in their prevention work, whether or not it's part of the model or the curriculum they're using or the campaign. I think they do it, and I think it works. I think it provides meaningful connections to people's lives and to policy that improves the efficacy. So for me, I think most clearly is that prevention, when separated from support for survivors and the voices of survivors, is really incomplete. And survivors of rape and sexual violence make visible gender-based violence and violence against women in ways that prevention programs can't always do on their own. And, you know, I've found, as I've talked to the people, that many of the men who view violence or sexual violence as sort of this distant issue that's removed from them, survivors matter a lot to them, more than this line that imagine if it was your sister or daughter or mother, but talking to a real person,
mm-hmm.
I think does so much more to reconnect prevention to survivors and to make it more effective and meaningful.
It's really interesting because the way you talk about it as being connected to these other realms really leaves room for how these things evolve. sexual violence and gender-based violence looks different than it did 30 years ago or 20 years ago or 10 years ago. And when we're doing prevention that focuses a lot on drawing lines, defining healthy versus unhealthy relationship and naming certain behaviors, not that that's not helpful, it definitely can be helpful, but it doesn't get to the more root causes, which the root causes aren't about being able to tell the difference between a healthy relationship or an unhealthy relationship. And people's behavior can change. If I'm waiting for someone who's doing dating violence prevention and I'm thinking that my examples of violence or dating violence are basically like Archie Bunker, 50s people, women doing housework and not being able to work or something like that, that's not necessarily relevant to how dating violence may be playing out right now. And if people don't aren't connected to that kind of larger vision, it's hard for them to even recognize this as an issue in their lives because the examples we're using or the language we're using is so far removed. I mean, this is just an example, but you were talking about bridge work. I remember working on sexual assault and domestic violence hotline, and you would hear things on the hotline, trends about, well, people are doing this, and a lot of people are saying this specific thing. It was a community-specific hotline, so we knew pretty much where people were, you know, they were calling from somewhere that had that shared the same area code, probably. And then you can use that to inform your prevention efforts. You get some information. You can get a feel for the climate through those intervention and victim support and survivor empowerment services and how helpful that can be and how it's often overlooked.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's how we got prevention in the first place, was people,
right,
survivors and women getting together and saying, this happened to me. When you bring together people who work with survivors and to some extent people who work with perpetrators, people who do self-defense with prevention, I think that everyone has a lot that they can learn from each other that comes up organically, that doesn't feel like this top-down cultural change model, but feels like this people coming together to generate ideas and to notice patterns and to make changes on their own in their communities and their lives.
Yeah, and you mentioned in, you know, your article about the grassroots feminist movement and how, you know, tensions now have kind of pulled us away from that. But in some ways, we're saying that I think that using the sphere is gonna, that you say like can be tethered together to kind of use all of the things that we've found helpful in the past.
And the including more voices, when you said something about change, and I was thinking this work isn't about like imposing change on communities. It's not about like giving people rape prevention, right? What even is that? How am I going to give someone rape prevention? It's a collaborative process. I mean, I think sex is a collaborative process. It's not a transaction, and it should be a collaboration. So how do we model that instead of giving, and it's the same frame as instead of giving someone consent or getting consent from someone. We don't give people rape prevention. They don't get rape prevention from us. We collaborate to create a community that supports safety and justice and health and all those things.
Yeah, and I think there's a disconnect to some extent between the sort of funding frame and the larger sort of narrative about prevention and what people do on the ground. I think on the ground, people have found ways to make it a collaborative process.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we can do a lot of work to make those strategies formalized and to give people access to the ways they work best and to sort of make that front and center in the way we do prevention, because I think people know how to do it. I think people know how to collaborate and make change. It's just a matter of talking about it. And I understand why we have gotten to the point we're at where it's sort of underground. I think for a long time feminism was a dirty word, and I think feminist social justice advocates did an amazing job sort of institutionalizing and building organizations for the long haul that they were able to sort of ride out a lot of that backlash, which we seem to be at a moment where things look like they could change.
So this, the chapter we're talking about is part of a larger project?
Yeah, so this chapter comes out of a book-length project called Some Men that I've been working on with Michael Mesner and Tal Peretz. So that'll be coming out in February. That's based on the life histories of men who have been involved in anti-violence work over the last 40 years and the women who have worked with them. And it sort of comes out of the findings and the research from that book.
Do you have any thoughts on how men and women in this work together.
Yeah, and I think it's an important question that we're maybe just starting to really examine. I think men's involvement is shifting. I think it's been very public that men have been sort of put front and center in engaging other men and preventing violence. And I think that creates some complicated dynamics when men are often celebrated simply for saying that they think that rape and sexual assault are bad.
Because that's the book-length project is about a larger thing, which is...
Yeah, so the book-length project, a large part of it is about men's pathways into the work and how those have changed between men getting involved during movement feminism and men getting involved sort of during the backlash years and then men getting involved today in sort of more institutional paths, through more institutional paths. And the book in that way is fairly academic. But we do sort of start to get into some of these questions of men's unique places in these movements and in these organizations as often held up and put on a pedestal and also simultaneously often facing scrutiny. And sort of what does that mean? How do men navigate that tricky location?
I guess that was my not all men question, just like hearing the title of Some Men versus the kind of catchphrase, not all men.
Yeah, so the Some Men, we did it in part because it's catchy and it sort of attaches to that conversation. But also, we're talking about a few different groups of some men. You know, some men who have become involved with feminism, some men who have chosen to be violent, and also to sort of puncture the pedestal to sort of say, look, these are just some men. They're not perfect. They shouldn't be held up on a pedestal.
You have been listening to a podcast consisting of a conversation with Max Greenberg, co-author of Before Prevention, The Trajectory and Tensions of Feminist Anti-Violence. Thank you so much for joining us, Max.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. And thank you also to Abby Sims and Sari Lipset from Prevent Connect.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CALCASA.org.